Hello and welcome to The Whole Health Cure, a space for trustworthy, science-based information on how you can live healthier and longer through the way you eat, move, think, and recover. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist, a physician, scientist, and lifestyle medicine pioneer with over 25 years of experience in patient-centered clinical care. This episode is the second of a two-part series on exercise with Dr. Peter Sprague. If you haven't listened to the first part, I highly encourage you to take a listen. There we discussed how exercise relates to our health and longevity, particularly at the cellular level, and what our bodies need to be healthy. In this episode, we're going to get into the specifics of designing an exercise program, or as I prefer to call it, an exercise prescription, given that the benefits are comparable or sometimes even greater than medication. Dr. Sprague holds the positions of Assistant Professor of Rehabilitation Medicine and Assistant Professor of Orthopedics in Emory University School of Medicine. He is a board-certified clinical specialist in orthopedic physical therapy and currently serves on the Committee of Content Experts for the American Board of Physical Therapy Specialties. Dr. Sprague has extensive clinical experience working with high school and collegiate athletes in an interprofessional team setting and has assisted in the development and implementation of screening procedures assessing for musculoskeletal injury for collegiate and professional sports organizations. Peter, great to continue this conversation.
Yeah, thanks, Sharon. Great to be here.
I want to talk now about more nuts and bolts because a lot of people listening are wondering how to implement everything you shared about the importance of exercise on our physiology and on our cells and gene expression, and what they need to do on a day-to-day basis to avoid disease and to age better, as you put so well in the last episode. To start off, can you talk about just different types of exercise and the kind of different categories, if you will, that we should be incorporating?
Yeah, traditionally we see resistive exercises. That's exercise that utilize weights, thinking of bodybuilders or strengthening or the traditional gym setup with the bench press, the squat rack, et cetera. We've gotten a little more sophisticated in our approach and the tools that we use to accomplish all that over the years. And then you think of perhaps the other big exercise component that's recommended with the CDC, and that's aerobic type exercise, or what they call moderate physical activity or vigorous physical activity. And so the two primary things that we think of with exercise are your aerobic activity and your strengthening based exercises.
And when a person does aerobic activity, so first of all, there are many types, right? So walking, running, jogging, dancing, different types, and at different levels of intensity. And how does intensity factor into these different exercises and its effect?
So even lower intensity, moderate, what would we call zone two heart rate exercise, where you're keeping your heart rate relatively low, but still performing physical activity for a sustained amount of time, has significant benefits. The benefits that you see with the lower intensity exercise is an improvement in cardiovascular health, vascular pliability. You'll see an increase in mitochondrial numbers within our skeletal muscle. Even you're going to see an increase in plasma volume, blood volume. You'll get more blood cells, et cetera. So there's a significant bump even with that lower level physical activity, especially for someone who's physically inactive and is starting activity. Then you can range all the way up into high intensity interval type exercises, and there's significant benefits there too. That would be where someone maybe does a little bit of a warm up with a lower heart rate and then does a minute or as long as they can, a higher intensity exercise that goes maybe above 80%, 90% of their maximum heart rate. And the benefit to that, again, for the trained individual is you're going to increase mitochondrial biogenesis, or you're going to have turnover of mitochondria, more mitochondria, better built mitochondria, which are cells that produce energy for our skeletal muscle, et cetera. And you're going to kick off the cellular processes like we talked in the last episode that promote longevity. You're going to allow some of the proteins that enact our DNA to actually improve its health in regard to telomere length, et cetera. So the high intensity and low intensity exercise gives significant benefits. The high intensity exercise may be favorable for someone who's trained. The lower intensity exercise may be favorable for someone who's physically inactive, although sustained steady state, lower aerobic intensity exercise is very good for even trained individuals, especially for recovery activities.
And we are using these terms moderate and vigorous. Can we take a step back and just define how a person knows if they're at moderate level or at a vigorous level?
Well, there's a couple ways to go about that. You can do it formally by looking at heart rate. And you can look at the heart rate of your heart rate during an activity that you're doing, like running, and relating it to your maximum heart rate. And you can, there's a couple equations that you can use for your maximum heart rate. You can use your 220 minus the age. That can give you a range for a maximum heart rate. You can also use something called the Carbonin formula, which takes into account more of your resting heart rate. So it's more contextual to the individual, perhaps, and thought to be a little bit more valid and precise. There's calculators that can be found. All you have to do is search for them, and you can find the Carbonin calculators, et cetera. And so you can base your intensity off of the heart rate. If you're working harder, if there's more metabolic demands, your heart rate's going to increase, and that's because the heart's trying to deliver oxygen and blood to the skeletal muscle to allow the activity to be sustained. And so higher levels of intensity result in higher levels of heart activity, so your heart rate will increase. The other way that you can measure this is just through perceived exertion. And some of our folks that are on medications that block heart rate response, things like beta blockers for certain heart cardiovascular conditions, would use a perceived exertion scale because the heart rate wouldn't be valid. Their medication is blunting their heart rate, but they can still feel a level of intensity that's related to more of a perceived exertion rather than a formal understanding of where their heart is related to their activity level. So there's a couple ways to go about it. If you look at what's recommended for the CDC in regard to their exercise recommendations, they recommend moderate or vigorous physical activity. And moderate activity from a perceived exertion standpoint would feel like you're out of breath a little bit, you're maybe walking at a vigorous pace, and you're probably able to hold a conversation and maybe talk in 3 to 4 word sentences before you have to take a breath. A more vigorous level of activity would be you might be able to get 1 or 2 words out, et cetera. So it's the difference between brisk walking and running. And both of those have benefits in regard to our overall health. I think where we get maybe a little bit more granular with it is when we're looking at training for performance. Endurance sports athletes, et cetera, will use periodization. Maybe where they'll do a lot of lower heart rate activity for a base period for a period of time to build their engine, so to speak. And then as they get closer to their goal race, maybe they increase their intensity bit by bit and decrease volume. So the advantage to maybe the sustained activity is that you're able to increase your aerobic capacity, so to speak. And then as you get higher intensity, you're able to sustain higher levels of activity for a longer period of time. And you kind of blend the two together through a periodization schedule for, again, folks that are interested in performance. For folks that are just interested in maybe improving their overall health, I think anything you can do is good. And probably the magic component to that is variety.
Yeah. And I want to kind of double click on the point that you were making about if a person is conditioned and has a low resting heart rate, some people don't hit the estimated maximum heart rate, but using the Carbonin formula that takes into account that baseline heart rate would be a better way to get what their kind of more true maximum heart rate should be, as opposed to the estimated 220 minus age. Because I do have a lot of people ask me, my heart rate doesn't get up with or without medication, but to the target heart rate, am I still getting a good workout? And going by perceived exertion or a more fine-tuned formula like the Carbonin formula, I think can help. And you also mentioned, you know, for athletes in periodization, a lot of athletes do like an 80-20 roughly in terms of kind of more continuous activity and then the more intense, as you mentioned, for performance. Is that, if a person is not at a level of professional athlete but wants to have a very high level of health but doesn't exercise, you know, 20, 30 hours a week like a professional athlete would, do you think that some modification to that would help that person optimize their routine? Or how would you advise that person to make their week combine the moderate intensity and the more vigorous?
So is this someone that's physically inactive?
Let's take someone who does moderate amounts of activity, so has some baseline level of cardiovascular fitness and now wants to optimize, but is not at a level of a professional athlete?
Yeah. So what I would say is it depends on largely upon what their specific goals are. If they're trying to train for a race and trying to improve their running time, there might be a thought that there's a little bit more of an intentional programming for them where there's specific workouts and specific days. They'll target specific heart rate zones for a specific amount of time. If it's an individual that's not so concerned with being as on target with that, then just increasing activity over time and increasing intensity over time is probably the way to do it. And what I would probably recommend is to start to bring their volume up. So if they're doing, let's say if they're running 10 miles a week, maybe target trying to get them up to 20 miles per week and keep them at the intensity that they're running at now. And a safe thought could be to increase the distance that they run by about 10% each week. And maybe have every fourth week be recovery week where they drop the volume in half and then continue on with their volume increase. Once they get up to maybe doubling their volume, then they can start to increase their speed a little bit and start to add some interval type training. So maybe one day a week becomes a key workout where now they're targeting being just at or slightly below lactate threshold for a period of time within their run, and how long that time is where they're at that higher intensity largely depends upon how long they're running and how many miles per week they run. And if you keep, you have to work in the total volume of running versus the intensity of running, how much volume they're going to be doing at that higher intensity pace, that's largely dependent upon the individual and how many miles they have underneath their feet, so to speak. So there could be a thought of increasing intensity after increasing maybe volume. That could be a way to go. Or another way to go about it is to keep the 10 miles per week and then just increase your intensity. So it all depends on what the patient's specific goals are. Maybe if they want to increase their running from the 5K distance and try 10K or half marathon, it would focus more on volume. If they're already doing a 10K and want to increase their 10K time, then we focus a little bit more on intensity. But there should be a thought for periodization that builds them to the point where when they get to a goal race or goal event, they're in peak performance at that point. And the way to do that is to build a little more volume at first and then reduce volume as you build intensity as you get closer, and then taper off as you get to the race. It's kind of the classic way to go about periodization for that endurance athlete.
And for strength resistance, so there are some variables to consider in the load, the number of repetitions. How would you frame how a person should think about strength resistance?
So there's a lot made of reps and sets, whether you're hitting strength or hypertrophy or muscular endurance or power. Those are the four main qualities of muscle that we typically think of training. And what we're starting to understand is that you're going to hit all of those qualities no matter what you do. There may be certain loads and repetitions that you could utilize that'll hit one quality a little bit more. If you want to work power, you're going to work higher loads with lower number of repetitions. If you want a hypertrophy, the hypertrophy thought is that 6 to 15, 8 to 12 repetition range will grow muscle. If you are working on strength without necessarily growing muscle, then you're thinking that maybe 4 to 6 repetition range. And it's not the magic in the reps, it's the load plus the reps. So you should feel some type of fatigue at repetition 6 or 5 if you're going for strength. It shouldn't be easy at 5 or 6. Same thing with hypertrophy. You should be nearing fatigue at around maybe rep 10 to 12, et cetera, to make that muscle respond, those muscle cells respond appropriately. Truthfully, if you're in the hypertrophy range, you're still training power, you're still training strength, and you're still training some muscle endurance as well. You're going to train power a little bit better if you go with higher loads. You're going to train strength a little bit better than hypertrophy if you, again, go at higher loads, a little bit higher maybe than you're training for power, et cetera. So there's maybe sweet spots, so to speak, but there's a lot of overlap. And for the physically inactive person, anything they do is going to be beneficial in regard to improving strength. And I think I mentioned this in the first podcast as well, even for the physically inactive person, you're going to improve strength even if you do steady state, low heart rate zone aerobic activity, which is really nice. I mean, so it's not so much especially for the person that isn't active, that's looking to get active, anything you do is going to improve your health status, especially initially.
I think that's a really helpful way to think about strength and just strength resistance, because a lot of times people are starting, they're at a gym, they're not sure, do I do fewer repetitions of a lighter weight? And what are the gains I get from that versus, as you just mentioned, if you do a higher weight and fewer repetitions, then is your goal getting the power? Is your goal getting your muscles to be bigger? And if I'm hearing the sweet spot where your muscles get bigger, but you also get some strength and you get endurance, is somewhere in that middle range of like around, you said 6 to 10 reps, or in that range?
8 to 12, 6 to 15, somewhere in that middle range. If you're feeling some fatigue toward the end of that range, then you're in that target. That's the hypertrophy zone. Your muscle's going to grow, but you're also going to get stronger. You're going to build a little bit of power, and you're probably going to build a little more muscular endurance. I think the advantage to more repetitions is you're training yourself to stave off some metabolic fatigue. So your muscular endurance is going to be better. That would be favorable if you have to lift and carry your suitcase because your wheels broke in the airport, right? Versus training with loads that are heavier, you're going to be able to lift a lot better. Your capacity for lifting something heavy is going to be better. So if you have to pick your maybe 5-year-old child up off the ground because they fell and hurt their ankle, et cetera, you're going to have the ability to do that because you've trained strength in that manner. So there's trade-offs. And I think for the normal, maybe non-athletically goal-oriented person, variety is the best. And training, the other thing that would be advantageous is to train compound movements. So movements like squats, et cetera, where you're working multiple body parts, that may be favorable versus working or isolating individual body parts.
And when you said, so there are two parts to this, you mentioned 8 to 12 reps as a sweet spot to hit all the different gains that you can get from the strength resistance. That's with one set. Is the goal to kind of get to the weight where you do how many sets of those repetitions?
Well, for trained individuals looking for strength gains or even hypertrophy, power, et cetera, maybe not so much for power because the load's very high, but you can go up to 10 sets. But that's for the trained individual.
In the same muscle group or in different muscle groups?
Same muscle group, perhaps different exercises. So we could do maybe a back squat, a hack squat, deadlifting, something that incorporates maybe lower quarter challenges, et cetera. You could incorporate 3 to 4 different types of exercises and work in up to about 10 sets. For the untrained individual, as much as 2 sets per muscle group would be helpful. And in fact, if you're untrained and you start to do more and create more muscle soreness without adequate recovery, then the exercise actually becomes detrimental.
In what way?
If you start to walk into the waters of increased injury risk, you get a significant amount of muscle soreness. A lot of times the muscle soreness from someone who begins a resistance training program who's previously been sedentary or physically inactive, and they've never done anything like that before, and they go into a program, whether it's guided or self-guided, and it's too intense, they get such a severe muscle soreness response that they're done with it. They're not likely to return back to that activity. If they continue with that level of training, then they're opening themselves up for injury.
Is there a rule of thumb, Peter, that if you're sore for, say, 2 days, you may have exerted too much? Or, I mean, because some soreness may be acceptable, but is there any rule of thumb to gauge how much is too much and how to advance your routine?
Typically, a delayed onset of muscle soreness will last 2 to 3 days, and I think that's okay. And usually the second day, you're a little bit more sore. And then a little less sore on the third day, and then fourth day, you're fine. I think what that tells us is that maybe during those days where you're experiencing that soreness, not to work that muscle again with that amount of load. It's okay to do a recovery workout, maybe where you worked your quadriceps out and you're sore a couple of days later, maybe on the second or third day, if you get on an exercise bike and just spin without resistance, that could be favorable, but don't reload the same muscle again. So I would say that maybe a sign that you've done too much and are wading into the waters of injury is if that muscle soreness goes beyond that 3 days. And you'll almost feel different too, even immediately after the workout if you've strained your muscle versus normal muscle soreness.
And how about the corollary, Peter? If you're not sore at all the next day, does that mean that you should have perhaps done more repetitions or higher load?
Nope. I think that's fine.
Okay.
Yep. I think that's fine. If you felt that your activity was very easy and you weren't challenged, then maybe combined with a lack of soreness, then yeah, but soreness isn't always the goal.
I think that's very helpful because I think sometimes it's hard to gauge if we've pushed enough or too much. So that's good to frame it. And if we want to work different muscle groups, upper body, lower body, how should we diversify that strength resistance program?
You could work upper body once or twice a week, lower body once or twice a week. And probably for folks that, again, if you're not training for something, some type of competition, et cetera, and you're trying to make the most efficient use of your gym time, training compound movements would be probably your best bet. Stay off the bicep curl machine, right? And go to more maybe overhead presses or what we call landmine presses, more full body type exercises. Same thing with the lower quarter. Maybe stay off the calf machine or the leg extension machine and go for more activities such as like goblet squats or squatting on a Smith machine or leg pressing where you're working multiple muscles within the same exercise. And the advantage to that is it's more efficient. There's probably a little bit more caloric expenditure and you're working muscles typically that work synergistically anyway. If you're working on a leg press or a squat, those are very functional activities. And we sit to stand an awful lot during the day, in and out of the car, up and down from our chairs, et cetera. Thinking of the same muscles being involved in stepping up onto a high step or a curve, et cetera. Those extensor muscles in your hip and your knee and your ankle are going to work to help propel yourself forward as well as decelerate when you step off of it. So using exercises that combine muscle groups in a more functional manner is probably the most efficient way to go about your training process.
And Peter, I'm going to give you a few scenarios that certainly I encounter in my practice, and maybe you can say how you would approach that person and help them get started on a good routine. So I'll start with woman, middle age, 50s, who wants to just maintain tone, good muscle tone. What would you advise that person's routine to look like?
This is a person that's been active and is used to working in the gym, et cetera?
As doing some mild to moderate amount of exercise.
I would incorporate some steady state aerobic activity probably, and then work on resistance training. I would probably ask what specifically that person's been doing and then what their goals are. We may be wanting to alter perhaps their reps and sets if they've been doing maybe repetitions or sets of 15 to 20 reps. They're looking to build a little bit more muscle or maintain muscle mass. Maybe we consider adding some sets in where they're working in with higher loads, more in that 8 to 12 repetition range, et cetera. We can talk about how frequently they're engaging in this exercise. What types of exercises have they been doing? Sometimes just adding some variety to a program can improve muscle strength, muscle activity as well. So there could be a lot of variables that you could go off of. As far as a general recommendation, I would say if the person's looking to improve on what they have presently, then perhaps adding another workout day per week could be another variable we could look at. If they're doing resistance training twice a week, adding a third day would be good, even a fourth day perhaps, in addition to different exercises and different reps and sets combination, et cetera. I would have that person who's somewhat trained, moderately trained, used to lifting and resistance training, maybe have them do 3 to 5 sets per muscle group. And some of those sets can be compound exercises and have the repetition range probably between 8 to 12, somewhere in there, to maintain hypertrophy.
And for the compound exercises, are we talking exercises at a gym using gym equipment? Are there compound exercises one can do at home with home weights or body resistance?
Yeah, there's so much you can do at home. So even just getting yourself a set of kettlebells and a goblet squat is very good. A kettlebell should be enough weight where it's challenging, like you should feel fatigue within that 8 to 12 repetition. And a goblet squat is where you just hold the kettlebell in front of you. The nice thing about the goblet squat is it provides a little bit of weight anterior to your center of mass. So it allows you to squat a little bit easier and with a little bit better form. So that's a really good exercise. You're actually working the upper body as well as the lower body because of the holding of the heavy kettlebell. So that would be a very good exercise that they could utilize. You could get dumbbells and just do some overhead presses. For folks who are physically inactive or who are older that don't want to go to a gym, there's some very useful things within your household that you could use for exercise and resistance training. You have cans that weigh so much. You can use those for overhead presses, et cetera. Of significant benefit for anyone is lifting and carrying something heavy. And that could be in your house, maybe the big container of laundry detergent that has some weight to it. And someone who's a little bit older and not physically active, that's a significant load for them. And just carrying that with their arm at their side will provide significant health benefits to their shoulder girdle. A lot of the problems that we see with our shoulder involve the rotator cuff tendons. And a lot of those problems occur, they manifest clinically typically in older folks. People who are getting rotator cuff repairs are in their 50s, right? They're over that age group. And the reason why is the tendon fails because it's been unloaded for so long. Our tendons, like all of our tissues, respond to load. And if we're not loading our tendons properly or appropriately, then the entire tendon from the middle portion to the outer portions isn't getting a loading response that produces more good normal collagen. If that tendon does not get that loading response, you start to see other cells infiltrate the tendon. You start to see cells differentiate into adipocytes that lay down fatty infiltrates. You start to see cells that look closer to chondrocytes that are cartilage-based cells within the histology of the tendon itself. And that's for tendon that's unloaded. If you load the tendon, then you maintain good tendon health and you're typically okay. And even our hip muscles, our glute medius muscle, I think over the age of 65, about a third of women will spontaneously rupture that tendon because of a lack of loading through life. So a way to load that would be to, again, carry something in one hand or hold something in one hand and then lift up your foot on that side so you're balancing on the other side. That puts a significant load on our lateral stabilizers. Very easy to do. Doesn't take a lot of time. You can do it while you're standing and washing your clothes. And I think just a little bit of an input, maybe 10, 15 seconds every so often is meaningful. Yeah, there's a lot of things you can do around the house to supplement or be instead of maybe that formal gym exercise equipment, et cetera. Around our property, I have a bunch of rocks I carry around. Silly as that sounds, some of them are pretty heavy and I just have them around the property. I'll just lift and carry and maybe put on my shoulder or overhead press and carry, and it challenges a lot of different parts of my neuromusculoskeletal system to do that. So there's ways to add some variety as well as meaningful interventions that keep you or maybe supplement what you're doing in a gym-based facility.
Yeah, it's picturing our ancestors doing similar types of movement as you were kind of going through that motion. And I'm going to give you another scenario, Peter. If a person is a male, 50s to 60s, wants to prevent heart disease and just live as many healthy years as they can, what would you advise them for an exercise routine?
So to reduce risk of cardiovascular problems, MI, CVAs, et cetera, aerobic exercise seems to be the thing that's going to favor them in that regard. Put them on an aerobic exercise program. I would also recommend that they give a thought toward not just cardiovascular fitness, heart health, vascular health, et cetera, but give a thought toward neuromusculoskeletal health. And what I mean by that is make sure that they're supplementing perhaps their aerobic exercise with some type of strength training, with some type of agility training. And I think no matter what age, I believe plyometrics have a place, even in your very older, elderly populations. You can work people up to plyometric type activities. They're relatively light. The load is typically tolerated well by our body's tissues. If you go through a progression that seems to be safe for someone, then at any age, you can incorporate those types of exercise. The cool thing about our bodies, the amazing thing about our bodies, is that they will respond to exercise no matter what age. There was a study that was done, I forget out of where, that looked at folks over the age of 80 and just had them, and they were relatively physically inactive, and they fell under the category of frailty, which is, you know, metabolic bone disease, low lean muscle mass, et cetera. And they were able to increase the lean muscle mass in all of these folks and make them more functional just by doing a stand to sit activity on a chair that was originally at a higher height. And as the person was able to do that, they lowered the height. And most of the participants, most of the subjects were able to get to stand to sit to a parallel femur position. The chair was that low, and actually able to do that with some load. And they were amazed at themselves, the subjects were, that they were able to accomplish that. And then on top of it, they increased their lean muscle mass on par percentage-wise as younger individuals would increase their lean muscle mass with hypertrophy training. Now, didn't increase it the same amount. They increased it based on the percentage of lean muscle mass they had going into the activity. But it's still remarkable how well the body responds. Even at that older age, we still have the ability to improve our processes. And it mystifies me why we're not doing it more.
Yeah, you and me both. I think having information like this is extremely helpful, because I think just knowing exercise is, you know, good for you, but really understanding the role of different types of exercise, how it affects function, longevity, as well as health, is just so critical. And making that connection for us as you're doing, I think it just helps awareness. And I think the more people are aware, the more proactive they are. I think oftentimes it's not until people lose a function and that they end up with seeing a physical therapist who says, well, this is how you repair, you know, a part that doesn't feel right or some injuries occurred. But we don't have really a way, certainly not in healthcare, where we start off with physical therapy to avert the outcomes that we end up seeing. So I think that's why it's so valuable to have you explain to us how to not end up needing that level of care down the road and doing it more proactive. Peter, with the time we have left, is there anything you want to touch on that you think is valuable for people to know in this mindset of being proactive and utilizing exercise to really be healthy for as long as we can?
The benefits of exercise are widely known. The thought is, how do we change behaviors, right, to come into line with what we know from an education research standpoint? And I think the important thing is to have the individual find something that they enjoy doing, something that's not screen time. And even sedentary activities are good. Reading is fantastic. I love to read myself. Knowing that sedentary, I'll just intersperse a little bit of physical activity. Also understanding that strengthening has its place, aerobic conditioning has its place, but movement also has its place. And you can challenge yourself a little bit beyond what you normally do, even with light movement activities, something like a walk through a park. You can challenge your balance a little bit. If you see a curb on the side of the park, step up onto it if you're safe to do so and try to balance on it as you walk along, right? Climb over a picnic table, as silly as that sounds. There's a wonderful, and I'll urge all your listeners to go and search for this, wonderful video you can find on YouTube. I think there's a couple of them on, they're called Parkour for Seniors. And you have seniors who actually utilize environmental obstacles as challenges through an exercise program. And they're climbing over picnic tables and going through railings and staircases, et cetera. And it's fantastic because it's really challenging their balance. It's challenging their visual spatial awareness. One of the things that happens with falls, there's a lack of visual spatial awareness within our environments because we're not interacting with our environments. Our environments are so well groomed in front of us that we don't have to worry about stepping over things and climbing over things. So to add those challenges to our physiology to allow us to improve our balance, our processes, our writing reactions, our speed in regard to maintaining our balance, we need to have those challenges put in front of us. And you can sprinkle those in, and they don't have to be, you don't have to do a lot of that type of activity to have it be meaningful. If you can climb over a picnic table, you're not going to have any problem walking through a park, right? You're not going to have any problem walking on a level surface on a sidewalk or in your home. You're likely not to fall if you're used to walking and challenging yourself on in more complex environments.
Mm-hmm. So essentially you get what you train for, and the body just adapts and has a remarkable capability of doing that. Well, Peter, thank you so much. This is really helpful, I think, for a lot of people. There's so many variables and knowing what to do and differentiating between how to think about an exercise routine is just very helpful for people who are either trying to get started or have already started, but just want to fine tune. So thank you for everything that you've shared.
Thank you for having me, Sharon. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and share it with a friend. Until next time, do something to help improve your whole health naturally.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.